Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge, and for Craig Blumenschein today and on Monday. Coming up later in the program, Rick Guillon takes you to Mott, North Dakota's central gathering place, the Pheasant Cafe, for this week's Prairie Plates. And Danielle Webster has some tips for making your turkey day safe and sane. Okay, it's the day before Thanksgiving, the busiest travel day of the year, and the time we all should be grateful that we, or our family and friends, made it to the turkey table on time, of course, unless they didn't. In light of the wonderful documentary on the late, great John Candy, the title of which was derived from a line in a classic Thanksgiving movie,
I Like Me,
and that movie itself, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, co-starring Steve Martin,
may I see your rental agreement?
I threw it away.
I thought we'd share a few stories from my Prairie Public colleagues about their travel nightmares. So we'll start with our radio studio operator, Tay Calloway, who originally is from Roanoke, Virginia.
Last year was my first winter in North Dakota. And let me tell you, winters in North Dakota are different from winters in the South. I thought I'd make a trip home for the holidays. Visit my family, watch my brothers open their gifts, relax, you know, the whole white Christmas thing.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
The morning of my trip, I woke up, packed my things like I always do for trips, 3 shirts, a pair of pants, you know, for a week-long trip, and then checked the weather. It said negative 20 degrees, wind chill, negative 34. That's kind of cold, but didn't think much about it. I figured everything would go normally. I'd just fly out. I never flew during the winter, and honestly, I had my first flight the year before this, so I was kind of new to everything. So I arrive at the Fargo Airport, check in, sit at my gate, waiting for my 12 p.m. flight. I chose this flight because it would get me to Virginia by 8 p.m. 2 short layovers in Minneapolis and Atlanta, and more time to spend with my folks. Then, a message from the airline. Flight delayed 1 hour. It didn't actually say 1 hour, but it was pushed back an hour. Disappointing, sure, but hey, I had a 4-hour layover, so no big deal. Somewhere between the flight is delayed, your plane is arriving soon, and just kidding, delayed, I got an $8 meal voucher, which at the airport buys you a half a bottle of water. But whatever. Eventually the plane would show up, still delayed, but with just enough time for me to sprint through Minneapolis and make the next connection. We wait for the plane to defrost, then we head out. I land in Minneapolis and get to my gate right before the scheduled departure time, only to find out that this flight has been delayed. Just like Fargo, it keeps getting pushed back. My 6 p.m. flight becomes a 10 p.m. flight. By the time we finally land in Atlanta, it's 1 in the morning. And guess what? Not delayed, but there's no more flights to my hometown. Nothing until 7:40 a.m. My options were to stay in the airport or take the terrible hotel they offered. I chose the airport because I didn't want to check in all over again. So I stayed up all night, watching YouTube, playing games, just me and my computer vibing with the airport staff. By the time boarding rolled around, I was already sitting at the gate. But then the gate changed. 4 times. 3 of which in the last 20 minutes before departure. I was running from zones A to C to D back to C. And if you've been to Atlanta, you know what I'm talking about. Finally, and I do mean finally, I got on the plane home. I've been awake for 36 hours at this point. When my dad pulled up to the airport, I was so tired I could barely recognize his car. I just stared at him. He had to get out of the car and ask me what I was doing. We get to the house, I hug my mom, I say hi to everybody, and then I go straight to sleep. Hours later, I wake up with the flu, and I spend the entire week in the basement, quarantined, and watching movies.
Nice around here, isn't it? I call it Christmas Town, better known as the North Pole.
Despite the trip being horrible, it was still great to be near my family. I would rather get sick and spend time with them than miss seeing them at all. So yeah, that was my bad holiday travel story. And oh, in case you're wondering, the flight back went peach perfect.
That's Tay Calloway and the double whammy of flight delays, which can't help your immune system, right? And a good old winter virus. Thanks for that, Tay, who provided the excellent production work on that piece. Up next in our Prairie Public staff travel nightmares, a cautionary tale on the need to pack lightly.
My name is Siobhan Fevick, and I'm the membership manager at Prairie Public. My daughter and myself and my roommate were traveling to Florida and naturally had to take a connecting flight in Denver. But, of course, there was delays, and we had about maybe a 10-minute window to get from one end of the airport to the other, knowing that Denver International Airport's pretty large. I also am a crazy packer. Don't like to check a bag, so of course I shove as many things as I can into a backpack. We start running. We have to run basically the entirety across the airport to get there. And in the nick of time, we do get to our gate. But right as we do, and people all around us, my backpack completely explodes. Everything goes flying. It was absolutely comical, and like how much things went to the point where some delegates wound up on a poor bystander that was kind of nearby us, to the point where I was kind of laughing up, trying to gather everything, not be mortified, and literally had to take these delegates off of his shoulder. It was pretty fun. And, oh, also, my roommate and daughter just stood there watching this happen, laughing at me. It was a crowning moment. We did make the flight, and we also were kind of popular with everyone else on the flight because of how much I was able to pack into that backpack. Everyone was nice, but also like, hey, could you pass me that book that flew out at you? It was by your feet there, but no.
So, Siobhan, did you learn any lessons from this experience?
Yes, actually, zipper awareness is very important with backpacks and where they're placed on the backpack. Never have them fully up to the top because you're running, it's just gonna slide. So make sure that they're always down on the side, and also have a little lock too because it'll help prevent explosions.
But you don't pack any lighter, do you?
Oh, gosh, no.
Thank you, Siobhan. Speaking of underwear, not the kind that lands on people, as was the case in Siobhan's story, but doing without. Here's our All Things Considered anchor, Danielle Webster, recounting her travel nightmare at a place I bet you've been to a time or two.
The very first time I ever traveled with my in-laws was when I was like 16. I met my husband like in middle school. I've known these people a long time, and they took us on like a summer trip. It was a road trip. They went to, you know, Minneapolis. They do Twins games and theme parks and tubing down the river and all this fun stuff. They do it. They've done it every year for decades. And I'm going on this trip, and it's going to be the best, you know, because I've got my cute boyfriend, and it's just going to be so much fun. And so the first thing we did was we were in Minneapolis, and we have time to kill before the baseball game that evening, and it was too early to check into the hotel. So we went to, where do you go in Minneapolis, right? The Mall of America. It's still the early 2000s, so like shopping at the mall is still a thing. And so yeah, we go in there, we walk around, we get some stuff, and we go out. And she's now my sister-in-law. She had a boyfriend with her on that trip. And the boyfriend, he turns around and looks in the back and he goes, oh my gosh, all our stuff is gone. And we were just like, what? That's the part of it that's so funny to me. Like, we're in this car and we're going to a baseball game. They've got nice jerseys hanging in the car so they're not wrinkled inside the bags. And it's a road trip and we don't have tablets and stuff, iPhones to keep us occupied on a long road trip. We actually had, like, it was like a battery-operated TV VCR, like an electronic thing that somebody could have taken and sold for something. That was still sitting, like, on the console. It was still sitting there. I mean, stuff of actual value. The baseball tickets were sitting on the dash. They took the bags of our clothes. Clothes. I mean, think about when you're traveling, all the stuff that you do travel with. I mean, I didn't have toothpaste. I didn't have underwear. I had to go underwear shopping with my future mother-in-law, you know? The whole thing about it is, like, I did go on in my life, and this is the man that I ended up marrying. I married into this family, and their whole joke with me to this day is, like, well, you married into this family of Griswolds. Every time we travel, there's something that happens. And a lot of times what will happen is like you get to the end of the trip and somebody will say it like, well, nothing really has happened so far on this trip. And then somebody else will pipe up and say like, listen, we aren't even home yet. Stop talking. You can't say those things until everybody's home, safe, and everything has happened without a hitch, because you just never know. Thing of it is like these are really fun people. I love to travel with them. They're generous. They'll take you anywhere you want to go, and you're guaranteed to have a good time, but you're also guaranteed to come back with a couple of stories of something, some hijinks that have happened.
That's All Things Considered anchor and regional news reporter Danielle Webster, proving you never quite know your future spouse until you travel with their family. Tells you a lot, right? Well, glad that worked out quite well for Danielle. On the other hand, for Kirsten Stavi, our communications and outreach specialist, breaking with holiday tradition and going to the supposed happiest place on earth instead caused her just a wee bit of stress.
Okay, so picture this. It's me. But I'm probably like 10 or 11 years old, somehow even more neurotic than I am now. If you can, like, buckle up if you can believe that. And we were fortunate enough as a family to get to travel for Thanksgiving. My parents loved to take that opportunity to go somewhere new. And so this particular year, we were headed to, drumroll, Universal Studios in Florida. Oh my gosh, you would think the most exciting place for a kid to go, especially on Thanksgiving. Wrong. Neurotic Kirsten wanted nothing more than your classic Thanksgiving meal, boring turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes. Oh, can you go wrong? No. It's what I wanted. I didn't want to be at the airport. I didn't want to ride rides at Universal. I just wanted everything to be normal and traditional for once. This kid just wanted things to be chill. So we're at the airport. We've, you know, covered we're neurotic. We're naive. We need things to be in order. And a little travel hack that I don't know if it's a thing anymore, but we used to fly standby all the time because we would travel. And if you flew standby, you could get a pretty cheap ticket. And as long as you weren't like hell-bent on getting there at a certain time, it was fine. You could maybe like not make it on a flight, whatever, you'll catch the next one. I couldn't quite wrap my head around. You go into an airport, all of a sudden you're hit with this like wave of intensity and urgency. Everyone is telling you what to do. They're like, take off your shoes, put your belongings in these boxes, and it's scary. And so we're on our way to Universal Studios, and I find out that we are in fact flying standby. And so we're at the gate, and we're just waiting, and my parents are having a great time entertaining us. I'm pacing. I should have had a clipboard. I should have had a pen that I could have clicked. Because I'm pacing around. I mean, I'm sweating bullets. I'm like, you guys, we have an itinerary. We gotta get there. What if we, I don't know, get there 2 hours later? And my parents are like, what if we do? And lo and behold, we make it on the plane. No problem at all. A couple meltdowns later, and I am buckled in, ready for my flight, ready to get to Universal Studios. We do get there on Thanksgiving Day. We end up going to IHOP because it is the thing that is open. I have not let go of my penchant for tradition, and I am, you know, knee deep in another conniption fit while my family is enjoying their pressed turkey and lukewarm gravy, having the time of their life. And I think I can look back on all of those experiences now and realize that I am so lucky to have been shaped by folks who had their priorities straight and maybe didn't get so stressed out. It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of
That's Kirsten Stavi recounting her travel nightmare, trying to roll with the punches there at the airport. And speaking of rolling with the punches, in a former lifetime, I used to be a gate agent for an airline. And during the busiest travel season of the year, you have to just let the angry customers' rants just sort of roll off your back. But, you know, as a passenger, I think we can all appreciate this. One thing that I wish that people at gates would do better at sometimes is communicate when there's a flight delay. Just let us know the news we can take, but just being in the dark is kind of a bummer. Well, that kind of thing happened to our legendary news director.
I'm Dave Thompson. I should title this, How Not to Get from North Dakota to Upstate New York. My brother and his family live in Clifton Park, New York, a suburb of Albany. I planned a trip to go out and see them, flying from Bismarck to Minneapolis to Detroit, then to Albany. Well, the first legs of the trip went fine, until we landed in Detroit. Then came delays and cancellations. I was to fly out at around 2 in the afternoon, but the flight kept getting delayed. The gate agent said it was weather-related. Another flight had been scheduled at 5:30 p.m. We actually boarded that plane, but deplaned after more weather delays. There were several of us heading to Albany, and our patience was beginning to wear thin. Gate agents were non-communicative. Finally, one person, whom I had never met, suggested we fly to Providence, Rhode Island. He had a brother who would meet us there, and then drive us to Albany. We all agreed. We contacted the gate agent, rebooked the flight, and the luggage actually transferred with us. The flight was smooth, and we landed at 1:45 a.m. We got into the car and arrived at the Albany airport around 3:15 a.m., where my brother and his family met me.
So come pick me up. I've landed.
Thanks, Dave. Glad that worked out for you heading to Albany, New York. Okay, we saved the worst for last. Let me tell you about my travel nightmare. It was 1993, my first year as an aviation student at the University of North Dakota. I was far away from my home in Maryland, and I didn't relish being alone for Thanksgiving, so a buddy of mine who was attending art school in Kansas City invited me down to partake in his Turkey Day festivities. Now, having passively checked the weather forecast, I knew there would be some snow on the way that Tuesday morning when I left Grand Forks, but I was not prepared for the intense blizzard already underway starting just before the Sisseton, South Dakota exit on I-29. I landed in the thick of it. The snowflakes were as thick as actual potatoes, not potato flakes. I exaggerate only slightly. My little Toyota Corolla's traction was almost non-existent. The snow was just packed. Of course, what do you think happened? Here came the trucks in the fast lane, passing me at warp speed, it seemed like to me. Their traction apparently was just fine, and yes, they kicked up a whiteout's worth of snow onto poor old economy car driving me. And I couldn't see. I was completely blind. It was zero visibility. I just held on for dear life and hoped that the interstate, though it was hilly in South Dakota there, I hoped that it stayed straight so I didn't run off the road or run into anybody or have anybody hit me from behind. This kind of white-knuckled big rig encounter repeated way too many times for my liking, and I was never happier to see an exit sign that read Watertown and a big yellow Super 8 logo beckoned me off the worst drive of my life. Oh, but that's not all. Next day, I encountered an ice storm around Sioux City. The road was a wreck, and I gave up once again. This time, I stayed at a Motel 6 for the night. Next day, all the snow and ice had melted, and on that final stretch of I-29 from the Missouri border to Kansas City, my car suddenly stopped. Managed to get over to the shoulder, I called AAA, and even on Thanksgiving Day, a driver came out within about half an hour, pretty good, and towed me to a service shop in the nearest town that, believe it or not, on the holiday was actually open. Now, they said their usual mechanic wasn't there, but the gentleman that was helping me determined that my alternator was shot, and that they couldn't replace the alternator, but he could give my battery a charge and enough juice to get to Kansas City, which was still about an hour and a half away, provided I didn't turn on the radio or use my wipers. So on my way I went. I had to pull over about 10 times to take a towel out and wipe down the caked up muddy windshield because, of course, I couldn't use the wipers. It was one dirty town. I had to keep the car running, so I crawled into Kansas City to my buddy Fred's house, an old Victorian converted to apartments. All his art school friends were there, and the giant turkey and trimmings were just getting placed on the big table. I just made it on time. And then Fred turned on a CD with Arlo Guthrie's famous Thanksgiving anti-war song that happened to be about littering and a feast that couldn't be beat, which this one was for me in Kansas City after the most harrowing drive of my life, but it turned out to be the best turkey day I have ever had.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Detheridge. I hope your travel is going well if you are traveling somewhere. If not, I hope you're safe and sound and comfy and cozy at home. And speaking of comfy and cozy, Rick Guion of Prairie Plays is going to take you to the Pheasant Cafe in Mott, North Dakota, in the second half of the program. Stay tuned for that. But first, a question about whether college is transactional or relational, sent Tom Ezern digging into NTSU's archives, where the letters of one of the school's first graduates revealed a powerful truth. For pioneers like Dr. Merton Field, higher education was built on mentorship, loyalty, and lifelong ties. Here's Tom's Plainsfolk essay.
In a meeting on campus a few days ago, along with many of the best and brightest at NTSU, interviewing a candidate for a high position in the university, I asked the question often on my mind these days as a, senior dude at our land-grant university, the People's College, as we used to say. Is higher education, college learning, I asked, fundamentally transactional, a matter of contracts and credentials, or is it relational, a matter of mentorships and relationships? I'll tell you later how that came out. In the meantime, I went from that meeting directly to the archives to dive into a manuscript collection of the Institute for Regional Studies, which in the 1950s, under the guidance of Professor Leonard Sackett, acquired amazing research collections, great and small. One of the small ones comprises the papers of Dr. Merton Field. The minutes of the directors of North Dakota Agricultural College record that on the 25th of June, 1895, they approved baccalaureate degrees for five young men, the first graduating class of North Dakota Agricultural College. One of them was the son of homesteaders on Apple Creek in Burley County, a thoughtful lad named Merton Field. He stayed on to attain a master's in biology with a rather obscure thesis, but also authored a bulletin on the medicinal plants of North Dakota. Thence it was on to the medical school at Minnesota. Field practiced in several Minnesota towns, did postdoctoral work at several institutions, including Harvard. He was an eye, ear, nose, and throat guy who practiced until 1951, died in 1959. Dr. Field had a sense of history and wrote a 131-page memoir about his youth on Apple Creek, which I'll get to another time. But given that question still on my mind, I was transfixed by reading his letters, in particular his experiences as a farm boy at the Ag College. As he neared completion of his medical studies at Minnesota, Field wrote back to Professor Henry Bolley at NDAC, who was a celebrity scientist by this time, to thank him for teaching and encouraging him for being, he attested, steadfast, though others were overcritical. There have been times, Field confessed, when I did not appreciate you as I do now, but through all I feel that you have been a generous and steadfast friend. I confess, when I read Field's letters to Bolley, I blinked away a tear or two, and then went on to read some of his late-in-life correspondence with another graduate among the first five, Robert Reed. There are intimate details dealing with matters such as the death of Field's wife, on which I here draw a curtain of privacy. But there also are stories about memorable relationships established at college. Recalling, he says, the years when we were classmates in that small Dakota school. Wonderful days for me, as without funds I had to make my way by doing any sort of work that came my way. Memory tells me of our great Professor Ladd, Field continues. And then he tells a story of when he ran out of money and decided to quit school. But Edwin Ladd instead encouraged him to enter an essay contest with a $25 prize. He won with an essay about his father's success as a pioneer farmer. Only later did he learn that Ladd was a judge of the essay competition. And so you and I, Field closes a letter to his old friend, are probably the only left of our class. Possibly because when I asked that question in the interview room, the candidate answered it pretty well. On the one hand this, and on the other hand that. But in the presence of Dr. Field, I realized her answer was itself transactional. So ask me now. I'm ready for the question.
Good afternoon. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The executive director of Visit Grand Forks says the area has felt the loss of some Canadian visitations this year. Julie Riggs says she's been monitoring the number of border crossings at Pembina.
Obviously, just because they cross the border doesn't mean they're stopping in Grand Forks. So we can't correlate those exact numbers, but the border crossings at Pembina are down significantly this year. So we have felt that impact.
Riggs says her organization will continue to advertise in Canada and will continue to welcome Canadian visitors.
When they're ready to come, we're here waiting for them with open arms.
And Riggs says she's talking with her counterpart in Fargo to maybe find ways the cities can coordinate and attract more visitors. The NDSU Extension Service is once again looking for people interested in learning life-saving techniques as part of the Stop the Bleed program.
Stop the Bleed is a hands-on training that allows participants to learn how to use tools such as a tourniquet or honestly, you know, any type of bandage or even your t-shirt to really stop an active bleeding wound in your extremities.
Angie Johnson is a farm and ranch safety specialist. She says they're now organizing for upcoming classes. Johnson says given the rural nature of our state and the high level of risk involved in farming and ranching, having proper training is necessary.
All it takes is one time for us to make a misstep when we're climbing up the tractor and we can easily fall and cut ourselves quite easily. And so that simple little fall could mean life or death, unfortunately. And so just being prepared on how do we respond to that in the event that help cannot arrive fast enough due to rurality, to the location of where a farm is or where you're at in your field or your pasture.
Johnson says they're hoping to hold classes in 9 counties between December of this year and March of 2026. She says they need at least 10 people to be registered in order to hold a class. For more information about the program, Johnson says contact your local extension office. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND. You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. It's so nice to have you along on this Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Coming up on this week's Prairie Plates, Rick Guion takes you to a very pleasant place, the Pheasant Cafe in Mott, North Dakota. And Danielle Webster has some food safety tips and just general tips for surviving this turkey day. But first, you've heard all about data centers. They're very much in the news here in North Dakota with one sprouting up in Harwood. but they are also big news in Indian country. Data centers, of course, power the internet and the AI boom, but they use a lot of water. On this week's Our Living Land, you'll hear about one tribe's concerns about a data center near their reservation.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Data centers power the artificial intelligence boom. They also use a lot of water. The Mountain West News Bureau's Kayla Bradel reported on the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe's concerns about a data center near the reservation. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Bradel about what he learned.
Here's a sample from Caleb's story.
Brian Arman, a commercial real estate broker, is driving to the Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center, which rises from the sagebrush like a pop-up book.
The building that you see up on the hill there, that's Vantage Data Center's Edge Core. That's a data center that's under construction.
Flat roof buildings stretch against brown hills. Cranes and excavators stand still like toys.
This is Google's data center over here, kind of the nondescript concrete building.
Here, global tech giants are racing to turn desert land into the backbone of the internet.
And now here's our conversation. First of all, can you explain what a data center is and their connection to climate change in the West?
Sure. Data centers are essentially giant warehouses full of computers that store and process the information we use every day. So, you know, that's everything from streaming Netflix to using AI tools like ChatGPT. And they run 24/7, so that takes a ton of electricity and cooling. And in the West, many data centers rely on water to keep those machines from overheating. And that can add up, especially in desert regions already facing water scarcity and climate stress. So they're part of this broader tension between the tech industry's rapid growth and the West's limited water resources.
Your reporting took you to Pyramid Lake, home of the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe. Can you tell us what you learned there about the tribe's concerns?
Yeah, the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe depends on water from the same watershed that supplies Reno and Sparks. And that's the area where a lot of these new data centers are being built. And tribal leaders told me they're worried about how this growing demand for water could affect Pyramid Lake, which is central to their culture, economy, and identity. Here's Chairman Stephen Wadsworth.
Every drop that's pulled out of the river is exactly that. That's a drop that doesn't make it to Pyramid Lake.
The lake is also home to the endangered kiwi fish and Lahontan cutthroat trout. So for the tribe, this isn't just about resource management. It's about protecting a sacred ecosystem that they've fought for generations to restore.
And what message does the tribe want to get across to policymakers and the public when it comes to the region's data center boom?
Yeah, the tribe really wants policymakers and the public to essentially zoom out, you know, to think about economic growth today, but what this all means decades from now. They're worried that as climate change makes water supplies less predictable, projects like these could make that strain even worse if planning stays short-sighted. As Chairman Wadsworth told me,
tribes always talk about doing things for, what, six generations. And right now, everybody's only focused on what's going to happen this year in the next 2-3 years, and that's just not far enough to think.
And that idea, thinking generations ahead, really captures how the tribe sees the balance between technology and sustainability in a changing climate.
AI and data centers are big topics across the country right now, but we don't often hear about their impact on indigenous communities. Why did you want to tell that part of the story?
Yeah, I think we all talk about tech infrastructure like AI or cloud computing. When we talk about it, it can feel abstract, even invisible, you know, but it's not. Like, these massive facilities are being built on real landscapes that are often tied to indigenous lands and water. So I wanted to show that the ripple effects of the digital world reach all the way to places like Pyramid Lake, you know, where people are still fighting to protect their water and ecosystems. And I thought centering indigenous voices in that conversation helps remind us that these are not just technology stories. They're stories about land, sovereignty, and survival.
You've reported on a lot of other indigenous water stories across the West. How does this story fit into that bigger picture?
Yeah, I think it fits into a pattern I've seen across the region where tribes that have fought to regain or protect their water are now facing new kinds of pressures. You know, whether it's agriculture, urban growth, and now AI development, these are all competing demands for the same limited water. What stands out to me is that tribes are often left out of the early decision-making, you know, even though they've managed these waters for centuries. So this story about data centers at Pyramid Lake is really part of a larger ongoing question. You know, who gets a say in how we use the West's most precious resource?
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
I like bagels.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
I'm here at the Pheasant Cafe in Mott, North Dakota with two good friends, Kevin Carvel and Bill Oberlander. We just ordered a couple of cheeseburgers. Bill claims he's a pheasant cheeseburger expert. Bill, what do you like about these burgers?
To be honest with you, I think that flat griddle that they cook them on is so well seasoned that it just gives it a unique flavor. I always get a bacon cheeseburger, fries, and a side of blue cheese dressing for my fries. Well, I like the kind of fecunda of the blue cheese, you know, something a little funky. And the fries are just crispy and delicious. And to me, a bacon cheeseburger is kind of one of the perfect, like, combinations of flavors and textures. So it's real important. You know, one of my friends in another small town, they recently lost their cafe, and it just seems like the community got gutted from it. You know, it's like a gathering place, and, you know, food is an important part of life. Can't live without it, so I mainly come here for the cheeseburgers. Every once in a blue moon, I get in the mood for a chicken sandwich or something.
What about the bar? The bar's next door. It's, I've had a lot of fun in that bar. The beer is cold.
Yes. Yeah. The beer is always available and cold.
And you can get cheeseburgers over there, too.
Yes. Yeah, you can order from the cafe in the bar.
Kevin, what does a small-town cafe mean to you?
Well, every community needs a gathering place, and, of course, in metropolitan areas, there are dozens of them, bars and cafes and coffee shops and et cetera. But in little places, they diminish pretty quickly because of the economics just don't support many of them. So Mott has this cafe, and they have a coffee shop across the street, which is nice. So they've got two places to for the community to get together at.
And how long have you been coming here?
Since I was 6 years old, I guess probably 1951, come in with my dad. And then it was a much smaller place, just a bar with stools at it and a couple booths. And I said, I think that grill back there still is the original one.
I'll get a bacon cheeseburger with cheese curds and a side of ranch, please. Now with the Pheasant, it's also a bar, and we need to discuss the bar side. We were talking a little bit about that earlier, but kind of the configuration, history of the bar, some of those things.
Well, it had a U-shaped bar, so patrons could sit on both sides and shout insults across the way to each other. You know, which was handy, and it was also handy for the bartender, who could serve people with one hand on the left hand and on the other hand with the right hand. So it was a very unusual kind of bar, but that was removed many years ago in a spasm of modernization, and Lord knows what's happened to it.
Well, there was another establishment down the road here called George's Office, and talk a little bit about that. You and I used to go there quite a bit.
Well, there were two bars side by side on the north end of Main Street, and I often get them confused because they've changed names a number of times over the years. One in the early days was called Rickson's Bar. And I think George's Office was originally called the Wolf Den, and out in front of it, where the Wolf Den sign was, they had a glass cage with a full-size mounted wolf in it. And I've often wondered what happened to that wolf, but it was named after a family called the Wolves. I think Casper Wolf and some other family, so that's how it got its name. But George's Office, George was a local guy from Mott whose parents ran the bakery here, and he went off after serving in the military to become an air controller in Alaska. And then the air controllers who had, they were a union, and then most unions are, of course, Democrats, but the air controllers had supported Ronald Reagan. They'd gone over and were considered traitors to other unionists when they'd supported Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was elected, and the air controllers thought, this is our chance, and they went on strike for big pay raises, and Ronald Reagan fired them all. So that didn't work out well at all. So George,
this show was not supposed to be about politics.
No, but George but George came back to Mott and opened up the bar, bought the bar, and opened it up and ran it until his, for many years, he just died here recently.
Well, these small-town conversations only happen at small-town cafes. This is Rick Eon for Prairie Plates. We'll talk to you next week.
Prairie Plates, Rick Eon hanging out at one of his favorite old haunts, the Pheasant Cafe in beautiful Mott, North Dakota. And one of his pals that he was hanging out with gets my vote for the most interesting man in North Dakota, and that would be Kevin Carvell, who has a home library that has grown to more than 14,000 books. We did a feature on Kevin on the Great American Folk Show with Tom Brousseau. If you search Kevin Carvell in the archives, you are sure to find it. Well, coming up, is your kitchen getting a little crowded? People making food, chopping up things, putting dishes away? Well, Danielle Webster has got some safety tips for you around Turkey Day. Stick around for this week's news podcast, Prairie Beat. The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND. Hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back, and thanks once again for joining us for Prairie Beat,
Prairie Public's weekly news podcast.
So Thanksgiving, of course, is this week, and wouldn't you know it, the first winter storm of the year seemed to arrive right on schedule, right before we're all hitting the road.
Ooh. Here's to hoping that everyone headed somewhere for the holidays. If that's you, hope you get there in one piece.
Absolutely. It seems like anytime there's significant travel involved in a house full of guests, it creates a few opportunities for things to get interesting. And luckily, I was able to talk with someone at North Dakota Health and Human Services about that.
Michelle Dutloff. I am the Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology Unit Director with Health and Human Services.
Oh, yeah, this ought to be good. Infectious diseases?
Right. Now, listen, here at Prairie Public, it's no secret how much we care about our listeners and viewers and members. We wouldn't be here without you all. So think of this week's episode as sort of a survival guide for Thanksgiving. Michelle Dutloff gave me a few really good pointers I can share.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm seated. I am sitting down right now and ready to survive this holiday. So what's first?
Okay, so up first, obviously, one of the very first things we think of when we have Thanksgiving ahead of us is the food. There's a lot of dishes being prepared. People traditionally like to serve turkey, but the protein possibilities, of course, are endless. And then there's the side dishes, salads, snacks, desserts, hopefully some comfy pants too, am I right? But as the Infectious Diseases Director at Health and Human Services, Michelle Dutloff knows this can be a perfect time to catch a foodborne illness. So she laid out some of the best practices when it comes to food safety.
You use a cutting board or use a knife or a spoon for a raw item like, you know, your raw turkey or other raw ingredients, eggs, and then you put that aside or a cutting board and then don't wash it. Hot soapy water you want to wash these things with. And then you use it for ready-to-eat foods, such as chopping a tomato to put in a salad or lettuce. That's how things can become cross-contaminated. It's not intentional, but just not thinking about these different steps that you need to take and just make sure you're washing things.
Oh, yeah, that's really true. And I think there's probably something to be said about that old saying about there being too many cooks in the kitchen. You know, it's great to have everyone prepping things and putting the meal together and all as a group. But maybe, just maybe, make sure you're communicating with one another about what utensils have been used for what purpose.
Yeah, that's a really good point for sure. I know for us at our house, like, it's always like, you know, one of my sisters is making the corn souffle, another is chopping a bunch of fresh vegetables and ingredients for a salad, another is making the green bean casserole. I always get stuck making the popovers, which I usually mess up. We're always grabbing at bowls and knives and cutting boards. It can get pretty interesting. But keeping stuff clean can help people stay healthy. Now, Michelle Detloff also mentioned to me another aspect of food safety that is a pretty big deal on a holiday like this where there is a lot of leftovers, refrigerating stuff properly.
Some things you can freeze again, but most of it's going to go in the refrigerator. So you want to do that within a couple of hours. That's going to prevent bacterial growth from growing and being in that danger zone, you know, which is 40 degrees to 140 degrees is that danger zone for bacteria to build up. And another thing you want to do is make sure you are putting things in shallow or smaller dishes because that's going to cool that food effectively and timely. So it's going to stay out of that danger zone longer. If you have a really big tub of like mashed potatoes left, you might have to separate those into smaller separate containers so you get that food to chill appropriately while it's in the refrigerator.
And stuff being the operative word, right, for stuffing. Okay, that I actually hadn't heard about and never really gave much thought to, especially since shuffling all these dishes around where there are so many dishes in the first place might seem like a lot of extra work. Usually that's my work on Thanksgiving since I can't cook worth a darn. But writing this down to remember for later, I think.
Yeah, I was a little interested to learn that too. And, you know, if you're sending leftover food home with people anyway, it might be easier to do that ahead of time as well. So just think of it as maybe, you know, less work for future you.
Yeah, it works for me. I know that Thanksgiving is the kickoff to pretty much the entire wintry holiday season, which also coincidentally is the start of respiratory illness season as well.
Yes, and it makes sense, right? People gathering in large groups and traveling around, sharing spaces in planes, trains, and automobiles, like we talked about a little bit earlier. Absolutely, it's prime time to spread around germs. Detloff told me a best practice is to get vaccines for things like flu, COVID, and RSV ahead of time. But, you know, if you're just not feeling well, staying home is unfortunately the best thing to do to keep others from getting sick too, especially if there are elderly, young children, or other immunocompromised people in your family.
Other things you can do is just making sure you are washing your hands frequently, doing good healthy habits like that, covering your sneezes and your coughs. You know, those are other things that, you know, you could do to prevent illnesses from spreading, especially when we are getting together.
The holidays can also be a pretty tough time for people's mental health. So for Thanksgiving, a lot of folks really like to focus on things they may be grateful for, staying present in the moment, staying off of their digital devices, and spending that quality time with family. And, you know, maybe even volunteering or giving back to their communities. Detloff says for folks who do struggle with mental health, they can always call or text 988. That is the suicide prevention hotline. And there are also resources available on HHS's website.
Yeah, you and I should take our own advice here and stay off those digital devices for sure. Well, Danielle, seriously, that's so important to mention. It's always good to pair the mental health with the physical health. It's really of the same and utmost importance. We certainly can't forget that aspect, which tends to be amplified around the holidays. Forgive me for maybe being glib about this, but there is, of course, that old trope of families getting together for the holidays and getting into fights over politics, right? It's probably worse than ever, I would imagine. Did Michelle Detloff have any advice about that?
You know, I did ask her about that.
I was really out of my wheelhouse, and I don't feel comfortable.
All right. Punting on that one. I can take a hint. Grin and bear it, I guess, eh?
Yeah, she says there are some resources available on the HHS website about that, too. You know, so for anybody struggling with those sorts of relationships. But ultimately, that's something a lot of folks are dealing with, too. So, you know, maybe just understand that you're not alone.
Yeah, point taken. You know, seriously, though, there are families, and you know, mine included in some ways, that are fractured over politics. It might not even be getting together around the holidays anymore, and that's pretty tough. So if you are getting together with loved ones and friends, maybe set some ground rules at the door, right?
Boundaries.
Yes.
There we go.
And take a swig for every time you mention something political. Wait, that's working in reverse. I don't know. We'll punt on the subject of politics too, I guess, right now, Danielle. What else is going on in Z News this week?
We averaged 7 turnaways every single day during the warm months.
Todd had some good reporting this week on some local efforts to combat chronic homelessness.
1.15 million barrels for this year, so 1.38% above revenue forecast.
Dave did a story about North Dakota's oil and gas production during the month of September. And obviously, you know, take a look outside, everyone. Our first winter storm has come and gone, and it's looking like winter is here to stay.
Sigh, indeed it has. But you know what, getting back to the vaccines for the flu, I had heard on NPR that the strain of this year's flu might be mutating and might be getting around some immunities. But another study said that, like, the current vaccines do a good enough job. So it's a good idea to go ahead and get that flu vaccine especially.
Yeah, they always say it's never a bad idea to get them.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Prairie Beat. Stay safe from those airborne and foodborne illnesses and politics at the dinner table. And if you partake, have yourself a very happy Thanksgiving. I'm Eric Detheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 26th. On this date, in 1896, the Jamestown paper reported Mrs. Swain had been taken home to New Rockford for burial. She and her lover were found dead in a Valley City hotel room. A note left at the scene said, "You will find sufficient funds in my pocketbook to bury us. Our last request is to bury us together without any fuss, and do not try to find out who we are. Parted in life, but joined in death." Cause of death was prussic acid ingestion. Mrs. Swain was thought to have become mentally deranged. She had four children and one of the finest homes in Eddy County. Mr. Swain had large land holdings and was one of the most prosperous farmers in the area. He was described as a kind and loving husband who knew of his wife's irrational infatuation with Frank Addison. He reportedly tried to reason with her to no avail. Addison was hired by Mr. Swain a year earlier to care for his stock while he went east. Upon return, he discovered Addison had stolen the affections of his wife. Mr. Swain said that Addison had his wife entirely under his control and followed her around with a pistol and a bottle of prussic acid in his pockets. Mrs. Swain told her husband that she could not live with him and would rather die with Addison. The couple arrived by train on Wednesday. They registered at the hotel as Mr. and Mrs. Owens. They were not seen again by hotel staff until Friday, when the door to their room was forced open. According to the Valley City paper, the dead lovers were locked in each other's arms. Each had a picture of the other tucked under their clothes. Frank Addison was buried at Valley City. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
All right, that's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Detheridge. Thank you so much for hanging out with me all this week. Tomorrow, we've got a Thanksgiving Day special from our friends at KAXE in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. It's Ham Radio. With award-winning cookbook author Amy Thielen, they'll be talking about gatherings around food with friends. Sounds kind of familiar. Coming up tonight at 8 p.m. Central, it's Travel with Rick Steves. Speaking of that, if you're listening during the afternoon broadcast, All Things Considered gives you a roundup of news from around the nation, world, and right here at home with Todd McDonald. So stay tuned. And thanks again for listening to Prairie Public. Have yourself a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving.